Hello everyone, good afternoon or good morning for those who like me are in their home countries. I would first like to thank you, Svetelina and Gayatri, for the invitation. I'm very glad to do my grand debut at OTGR by presenting a seminar. I will now start sharing my screen with you because I have some slides to share. One second. So here we are. Well, I will initially start by giving you a bit of introduction on the background of this research. Political crimes and amnesties, scope and limitations to transitions to democracy is part of a bigger project that I conduct at the University of Maastricht. There, I work on the topics of political crime. I analyze them through the lenses of extradition and of amnesties, also by conducting some empirical qualitative research on the cases of Brazil and South Africa. Currently, I came to Oxford and joined the Latin American Center to do the empirical analytical part concerning the Brazilian case. What I will present to you today, though, is part of the first phase of my research, where I do a more doctrinal research on the relationship between amnesties and political crimes. Hence, political crimes and amnesties is a work in progress. And as you might probably see, I still have some open questions in my mind that I plan to share with you today. So before I jump in the topic, I will give you a bit more of structure on what I plan to say. The starting point of my presentation will be to explain the motivations as to why I decided to analyze political crimes in the context of amnesties. Why is this a relevant question currently? Secondly, I will present a definition of amnesties that I use. I will describe the procedural aspects of amnesties and bring an attempt to present different rationales involved in it, and relating these rationalities to the interests of the subject that are involved in the amnesty decision process. Finally, I get to which crimes can figure as the material scope of amnesty. And then I analyze the relationship between amnesties and political crimes. By doing so, I aim to demonstrate the gaps in the amnesty literature concerning political crimes, despite their relevance as object of amnesties. As well, I try to pinpoint aspects of amnesties that might affect the concept of political crimes. Finally, I arrive to what amnesty laws label as political crimes, and I attempt to design the elements of crime that are present in political crimes. Being political crime a crime, as the label would say, the final objective is to analyze them as a normative rather than a political category. And with this, I would like to highlight that when I do this parallel between normative and political concept, is because amnesties tend to be mostly guided by political concerns rather than legal aspects, which does not mean that the normative standards are not applicable and should not be applicable. One of them raised by me is a model where rule of law is the final goal of amnesties. And with this, I aim to limit the discretion that states usually have in granting amnesties. Hence, according to the thoughts that I will present to you today, the normative background is not only beneficial because it gives a bit more of security and structure to the amnesty procedure, but also is necessary to delimitate to limitate states. Why then do I investigate political crimes in the context of amnesties? The first reason is because both of them are linked to transitions, which is our connecting topic today. I would say that both of them are present in transitions from war to peace, from authoritarianism to democracy, or any other sort of conflict. And amnesties, on the one side, are a mechanism that was present for a long time, and as a peace instrument. And by this, I could do a big historical diversion and go to Greece, which I will not do. Currently, in the transitional justice framework, amnesties account for over one half of the transitional justice mechanisms, which highlights the relevance of the instrument. However, at the same time, they receive a lot of criticism and they are frequently challenged, as it happened in many cases in Latin America, apart from in Brazil. When I say that I will talk about amnesties, I would like to highlight also that we have different types of amnesties. We have conditional amnesties and unconditioned amnesties. We have amnesties that are a result of a fairly open public discussion of the decision on granting them. And we have amnesties that are simply imposed by dictators. So these nuances need to be analyzed when we talk both about amnesties and when we talk about political crimes. And why here do I talk about political crimes? Most amnesties cover political crimes. They account for approximately 85% of all the amnesties granted during the period from 1990 to 2016. Thus, my question is, what are political crimes in the context of amnesties? This will be a pending question for a while that I don't plan to answer at the beginning of my presentation. Most part of the literature tackles the political crime, the crimes that can receive amnesties under the label of international crime. And this is part of a massive literature that I have come across. But I deem this to be a bit problematic for two reasons. First, because international crimes, they are only accountable for 22% of all the amnesties granted. So even though they are a very problematic part of it, they are not the biggest part of it. Second, because amnesties seems to me to be rather a problem of domestic criminal law, or at least the amnesties that I focus on my research. And an example of this is the clash that South Africa had with the Apartheid Convention of 1973, where they did not sign nor ratify and did not do so until nowadays, in order to protect at the time the regime that was in power and nowadays possibly to protect their amnesty law. The concept of political crime and a possible overlap with international crimes become a source of bigger concern when data shows that free democracies are decreasing on their quality. And free democracies are traditionally the ones that do not consider international amnesties for international crimes. This overlap between international crimes and amnesties is hence a problem, because it might put in danger the compliance with human rights. And with this, I try to argue that amnesties and in turn political crimes lack a normative background, which as a consequence leave states to the discretion to apply them according to their wishes. Second, I argue that political crimes can offer, or at least offer, some normative background to amnesties, since we are talking about a crime, and crime traditionally demands a definition to be aligned to the legality principle. And as a consequence, I propose some elements that derive from the amnesty analysis to figure as elements of the crime, of the political crime. With this, I jump into the amnesties overview. I know I promised to not do any historical diversion, but here I need to jump into Greece, 404 before Christ. The very big root of the amnesty word is amnesia, which is a Greek word for oblivion, forgetfulness. And even if historically amnesties were related to oblivion, and recently they might have changed, the biggest part of amnesties are still not related to memory and truth recovery. Less than 20 out of 289 amnesties from 1990 to 2016 are conditioned to truth revealing. They have been thus used to keep, mostly used to keep peace between conflicting states and political enemies. My working definition of amnesties is a state official policy or law that grants forgiveness in criminal jurisdiction to prospect and previous consequences of criminal behavior in response to to exceptional circumstances. And by this, we have five features from amnesties that emerge, and I will briefly explain them to you. The first is that amnesties were and remain an expression of sovereign power. And the relevance of this is because when it started back there, a bit after Greece, with the kings granting pardons to the citizens, they were related to an expression of sovereign mercy. And nowadays it expressed in the most various ways. We will approach it when we talk about the procedures in amnesty. The second is the repercussion in civil and or criminal consequences of the crime. First, when addressing the criminal consequences of the crime, they are both related to prospect consequences in the sense that a crime is committed today, an investigation is still not in place, but amnesties already give some protection to this perpetrator, and also to previous consequences in the sense that the crime is committed, the individual is sentenced, and then amnesty comes. For both cases, amnesty would cover the criminal consequence. The second aspect, and for me maybe a bit more problematic, is that amnesties, according to countries, can cover or not the civil consequences of the crime. And in the cases where they would cover also the civil consequences of the crime, this would implicate keeping victims absolutely unassisted, which is a very serious problem when we talk about gross human rights violations and international crimes. From the criminal law perspective, I would also like to highlight that amnesties are not do not bring a statement concerning the liability of the crime, but rather of the responsibility of the individual for its consequences. And the message behind it is that when we talk about someone who committed a political crime, the amnesty message is, well, the crime might have been committed. This person might have perpetrated the crime, and still we will choose to not prosecute it. And obviously, depending on which crime was the political crime in case, this might have serious consequences to the moral and moral message behind it. The group targeted by amnesties is necessarily, as I put in the title, a group, not an individual. Amnesties are not namely destined to individuals, as is the case, for instance, with pardons. And we have very recent examples of the pardons given by the former American president. When we talk about the time frame of amnesties, They have a predefined start and ending point. They cover crimes from date A to date Z. They are not unlimited in time. And also it covers both past and future conducts. And we talk about future conducts is because amnesties, especially if they aim to involve individuals that are currently in conflict, are currently part of the conflict, rebels, and etc. They can serve as to stimulate them to lay down their arms. And last but not least, the exceptional context. And by exceptional context, I mean that amnesties, as we established, are usually a result of wars, of dictatorship, and some other sort of conflict. And by saying this, we assume at least that this is not the norm, rather the exception. So they are usually applied in exceptional contexts. And I suspect, and here I give a bit of a hint of my views on political crime, that the contextual circumstances of the moment when amnesty was granted will operate a relevant standard in the analysis of political crimes and in defining the different levels of violence that can or will be tolerated by a certain amnesty. Even if I have briefly mentioned pardons, other forms of state leniency towards criminal behavior are not in the scope of this research, such as immunities, statute limitations, and others. As I said before, amnesties are very varied. We can have many different amnesties with many different features. And usually what makes the difference between them are how they are granted. And that's why I decided to talk about the procedural aspects of amnesties. I divided the procedural aspects into two, the phases of amnesty and the stakeholders, which I will present soon. When talking about the phases of amnesties, by analyzing literature, I realized that most part of the times amnesties are mentioned quite unsystematically, in the sense that sometimes we talk about granting, sometimes we talk about applying. So I try to organize this into three phases. First is the granting phase, and I would say that this is both the most important and common one. The granting phase analyzes the decision of granting amnesty and which legal instruments are used for it. There are three different legal instruments: law, peace agreements, and executive discretion. And the difference between them is that there are some nuances according to the level of public participation that they involved. And even in executive discretion, we can have executive decrees that are later discussed with the public and in a referendum or something like this. And also we can have laws that are amnesty laws that are passed by a non-democratically elected legislature. So these are relevant nuances when we talk about the instruments of amnesty. The second relevant part of the granting phase for me is the conditionality of amnesty. Amnesties can be granted with conditions or not, and the condition would be the obligation to apply to amnesty in order to provide the perpetrator the chance to obtain or retain amnesty. They play a relevant role in amnesty since, according to literature, the legitimacy and capacity to contribute to peace of an amnesty can vary depending on the existence and the quality of the conditions attached to the process. There are mainly two types of amnesties. There are mainly two types of conditions: the ones that focus on combatants and the ones that focus on victims. There are also unconditional amnesties. They consist of 35% of the total of amnesties analyzed, of the total of 289 amnesties analyzed between 1990 and 2016. And here I got some data to show which are usually the conditions that are present in the conditional amnesties. And as you can see, telling the truth and repairing the victims are not the biggest part of them. And this I would like to highlight because we will analyze this as an element later on again. With this, I move on to the application phase. the application phase, depending on which decisions were taken during the granting phase, might require the beneficiary to apply for amnesty. If the amnesty is conditional, the beneficiary needs to apply to receive the amnesty. This means that there is a concrete case analysis before the amnesty is applied to the individual case. Hence, another state authority would analyze the application, which is also helpful to give a bit more of power balance in the amnesty process. There are also applications eventually in the unconditional amnesties. They could come as a defense in a criminal proceeding, or they could come as a sort of habeas corpus or a laissez passer. I explain here when amnesties can appear as a defense. For instance, someone that committed a crime and is being prosecuted in court, this person can claim that in fact there is no reasoning for this prosecution since this person is covered by a previous amnesty. And this would happen on case by case. Differently, I labeled that amnesties can be used as a form of laissez-passer in the case that despite not existing any conditions to the amnesty application, there is a formal process where you have to apply and appear before a certain authority. In this case, there would be some analysis also of the suitability and legality of the amnesty application, regardless of any conditions. And in all of these three cases, political crimes could be a requisite to be evaluated in the amnesty application process. In the application phase, I would like to highlight that in all of these cases, there will be an individual case analysis. By regarding any procedure of application, those amnesties lower by disregarding, sorry, whenever it's not the case of needing an application phase for an amnesty for an individual to benefit for the amnesty, it would mean that these amnesties lower to zero the burden of proof and truth disclosure and victim reparation. And with this, I would like to do a very brief reflection on with my criminal lawyer side speaking out loud. Because when we talk about a person that commits a crime and alleges and claims that the crime was committed in self-defense, this person still needs to go to court and prove that this was the case of self-defense. And when we talk about amnesties that are granted without any condition and without any application procedure, we're talking about amnesties where the person doesn't need to basically say anything to benefit from this pardon. After this brief reflection, I would like to jump into the recognition phase. In the recognition phase, the amnesty validity is analyzed in the sense that it's analyzed broadly as the amnesty provision is analyzed broadly, not on a case by case basis. This could happen in conditional amnesties, as it was the case of the Azapo case in South Africa. And it can also happen in unconditional amnesties, as it happened in Brazil. In this case, it's still possible that legal measures are taken erga omnes, challenging the validity of amnesties rather than on individual basis. With this, I move towards the stakeholder analysis. The stakeholders are the persons or entities with an interest or concern in the amnesty process. I divided them into three categories: the beneficiary, the granting authority, and I think the most problematic one, but I want to take the chance to raise this concern, that are the what I labeled as bystanders. The beneficiaries of amnesties are the perpetrators. They are the ones that benefit either immediately, either after the application or the condition implementation. The granting authorities I labeled as the state. As I said previously, the amnesties are traditionally given by those who hold power to do so. And since they approach the forgiveness of crimes, those who have the legitimacy to forgive these crimes are the ones who would be responsible for the criminal prosecution, which would mean the state. And in this category, I would like to highlight the presence of the self-amnesties. And the reason why I highlight their presence is because whenever the state uses an amnesty provision to forgive the crimes committed by their own agents, the logic behind the amnesty granted diverges, because whenever the state forgives a non-state actor for a crime committed by it, it is using the fact that the crime was committed, even if not directly, indirectly, against the state who has the norm. However, concerning state actors, the state leniency with them does not make sense. Actors, as it would be the case of actors in political crimes. And here I would raise the question, can the state be both the victim and the perpetrator of a political crime? And finally, I get to the bystanders category. By analyzing them, I would like to give a bit of insight on how I label them. They would be the subjects who see what is happening without being actively involved in the amnesty process. And here I highlight, they are bystanders in the amnesty process rather than in the crime, because obviously victims are not bystanders in the crime. And why do I say this? Because both victims and international community are remain quite distant from the amnesty granting, and sometimes whenever conditions are not present, also from the application of amnesties, which I find to be very problematic. By victims, I am talking about those who are directly or indirectly impacted by the amnesty. And by international community, I talk about the states other than those who are directly involved in the conflict or war. And as an example, I will talk about the American presence in the Condor operations in Latin America in the 80s. With this, I would like to start discussing the rationales behind amnesty and the rationales behind prosecution. The rationales would be the reason behind the amnesty existence. It is necessary to comprehend them because they are the justifications behind prosecution and punishment in both domestic and international criminal law, and relate them to transitional justice. Two premises are necessary to be established here. The first one is that there is not necessarily a direct opposition between amnesty and prosecution rationales. I do believe at the end that in certain cases, depending on how the procedure of amnesties is developed, it is possible that amnesties can cover at least some of the rationales involved in prosecution. And the second premise is that both of these aims are achievable, which would be, and the analysis whether they are achievable or not would be a complete different research. Finally, I treat it in a twofold manner. First is that amnesties can both lead to achieving the rationales of prosecution, or the rationales behind amnesties are more important than the ones in prosecution. With this, I talk about which are the rationales then. In criminal and international criminal law, the rationales behind prosecution are usually retribution, deterrence, restoration, and expressivism. I will not explain each of them, but I would like to point out, to ask the question whether can amnesty achieve those objectives? When we talk about the retribution aspect, the moral analysis of concerning the commitment of a crime, it seems to be the case that eventually amnesty can give at least a bit of this moral aspect, but it really depends on the procedure and on the conditionality. Concerning deterrence, I would be a bit more hesitant because amnesties have been repeatedly granted. We have some examples of, for instance, Sri Lanka, where we had 32 amnesties passing, which means that they still remain necessary because the crimes related to conflict keep on being committed. With this, I would like to address restoration and expressivism, which as well can be achieved by amnesty depending on the procedure which is used, depending on how much victims are involved in the amnesty process. Then I jump to transition. What are the rationales behind transition? The first one I would say that is the most immediate one, that is peace. And when we talk about peace, I would just like to do a small observation in the sense that amnesties are far away from being a requisite to achieving peace. Data shows that they are granted in high rates, not only in pre-negotiation, but in fact, during all the other phases, conflict negotiation, renegotiation, mid-negotiation, comprehensive agreement, and post-agreement. And finally, when we talk about truth, as I mentioned before in the previous slide where I showed the conditions to amnesties, it is also possible to see that truth is not a frequent condition in the amnesties, even in the later, in the late years. The relevance of this question is then what stands out? And here I propose some to weight to balance these rationales. The need for a retribution, deterrence, and restoration or expressivism is either outweighed by the need of for peace, truth, and reconciliation, or they are as important as the need for peace, truth, and reconciliation. The balance should bend to the side of justice whenever there is a close relationship with the rule of law. Punishment and prosecution are deemed as signs of institutionalized accountability, which means that in longer terms, societies might pay a price for skipping this phase, put it like this. The balance should pend to the side of peace whenever a society can be so fragilized that granting amnesty is the only way to achieve peace in the short term. In the case, retribution, deterrence, and expressivism and restoration, in case they are not achievable, peace might be the only way to do so, which means the best outcome would come through amnesties. And in this case, we cannot deny it. We have different interests that are present in amnesty. In this part of my presentation, I would address which stakeholders are related to different interests. At the end, I would like to relate these interests to political crimes in the sense that when the state decides to criminalize a certain conduct, it aims to, with this norm, protecting a certain interest. And my question would be, which is the interest protected by political crimes? From the state perspective, the interest would be governability and political stability, with two important variables as limitations: the existence in this state of strong institutions and the rule of law, in the sense that the state cannot put in the scope, in the bulk of amnesty, whichever content they would want. The individual perspective would have as an interest the freedom of political prisoners, the individual's right of political expression, and also the reintegration of former combatants, in the sense that whenever someone is sentenced for a crime, they lose most part of the times their political rights, which would mean if a state sentenced people to political crimes, at the end, this would mean that they remain outside of the political life of the country. And finally, society, victims, and international community's perspective are reunited by peace, among other interests, which I could explain by truth, acknowledgement of the violations and reparations. But how do they relate to political crimes? Which of these interests are at stake in the norm protection of criminalizing a political crime? I suspect that is the state perspective that is at stake. However, whenever the criminalization of a political crime would harm more than protect it, amnesty should be granted. And with this, I jump into the heart of this presentation: which crimes can figure in the scope of amnesty. Usually, some criteria are delimited to choose which crimes should or should not be in the scope of amnesty. These criteria varies from limiting dates, crimes that are committed from a certain date to another date, also by listing crimes, which means in an amnesty law, there would be a list of which crimes could be forgiven. And finally, and most commonly, the third is to introduce amnesty to political and related crimes. These three criteria, they can be applied cumulatively or alternatively. And here I question, do these crimes that receive amnesty have any specific quality? Which crimes can be granted amnesty? Since the majority of them are political crimes, as I previously said, what are the political crimes? So far, I spoke about political crimes and I purposely did not explain it. The first pillar is that I have to set here is that I talk about political crimes because this is the term that is used in most part of the amnesty provisions. But in fact, what I want to do is to question this name. Literature has traditionally divided it in six categories: economic crimes, crimes against individual, sexual violence, evasion and desertion, and international crimes and political crimes. However, this categorization leads to the assumption that there could be no overlap, when in fact, it's all about the overlap. Can sexual crimes be considered a political crime? Can international crimes be considered a political crime? Here, I recall the concept of amnesty that I put before. And let's take a hypothesis where the American capital is invaded. Let us suppose that a few years later, the American president, when leaving his or her mandate, decides to pass an amnesty act that forgives those who were sentenced to public patrimony discussion, bodily injury, and homicides committed during this invasion. The invasion is clearly far from being ordinary. It was an exceptional context. If those crimes were committed not in the context of this exceptional event, but outside the invasion, there would be no forgiveness for them. Starting from the premise that amnesties are granted to crimes that are committed to what we labeled before in an exceptional context, abstractly, every crime could be considered for amnesty so long as they are committed under this umbrella. Hence, hypothetically, every crime could be granted amnesty. But is that so? Here, I start talking about what I suspect cannot be part of amnesty, neither, as a consequence, be considered political crimes. I address international crimes and gross human rights violations. All of them are hardly ever explicitly listed in the amnesties, even though in reality they are sometimes covered by them. How can they not be listed and still be eventually covered? States apply diplomatic writing when defining political crimes, in the sense that they define without defining a lot. Usually, these crimes are hidden behind the writing of the amnesty provisions. And what hides them? Sometimes one of the categories that hides international crimes is the category of political crimes. The difficult issue with the relationship between international crimes, amnesties, and political crimes is that amnesties cover serious human rights violations do not promote peace, and this is a result of empirical research done by Dancy. Even if passed after a conflict that has ended, hence, I ask the question, are international crimes and gross human rights violations subject to amnesty? Can they be considered political crime? The first consideration is that there is no legal instrument or hard or soft law that expressly attests the impossibility of granting amnesties to crimes, not even international crimes. However, there are documents that point out to the need of investigation and or prosecution according to the legal order, which is named as the duty to prosecute. It is ironic, though, that the only international document that refers specifically to amnesty does so by encouraging it. This controversy is bigger than this presentation, so I will only use it to delimitate the concept that is relevant to me, which is political crimes and amnesty. The link between the obligation to prosecute and amnesty is that whenever the duty to prosecute applies, amnesty cannot exist since they bar the investigation, prosecution, and punishment. There are three levels of analysis of the duty to prosecute, which I will skip due to the time. But what I would like to highlight is that there are different levels of commitment to prosecution among these instrument conventions that create the obligation to prosecute, human rights treaties that approach it through the right of remedy, and customary international law. And my final question would be, can these limitations affect political crimes? Should they affect political crimes? And my premise is that aligning amnesty to political crime, the political element that gives amnesty the possibility of giving a more lenient treatment to a crime does not seem to be the same element that could lead for a more serious treatment, for instance, towards an international criminal court. It would be rather contradictory. For instance, if a public officer performs conducts that lead to systematic attack of a civilian or a military tortures a prisoner, can the same political element be enough to grant forgiveness? What are then the political crimes? If this limitation says that what cannot be political crimes, the most relevant question would be, how does this exceptional political element translate and connect to political crimes? Here, I would like to stop calling them political crimes, and I am approaching the end of my presentation. I would start calling them crimes with a political element. They are conducts united by the existence of a political element that links the crime with amnesty. For this, I have some hypotheses. I have found some hypotheses in literature, be it the motivation behind the conduct, the target aimed, or the context in which the crime is included. What does literature say? It says that political crimes are very various. they can start from defamation to extreme violence, which shows that there is a big range of discretion in defining them. Still, there are some common places that I would like to point out here. Behind these different labels that I found in literature, for instance, political and politically motivated crimes, or political and related common crimes, what unites them is a conduct, is that there are some conducts that are fully committed to this political element, which means that if not in this in this state analysis, they would not be a crime. And there are conducts that are only partially related to the political element, which means that if you remove the political element, they would still be considered crimes. By as an example of the first ones, I could mention treason, rebellion, espionage, false propaganda, between other elements. And as an example of the second category, I could, for instance, mention any theft in the cause of a political fight. The big questions are, what determines the crimes that are fully affected by the political element as political crimes? Concerning those crimes that are partially affected only by this political element, which graduations are allowed for it to be granted amnesty in the partial crimes? Literature have been approaching it through the lenses of extradition. However, I take here a step back to consider whether this would be the solution, or even if this would be the solution, why would we put the two different legal categories in the same level, just because they have the same label, political crimes? I take this step back to disconnect from extradition, labeling them as crimes with full political elements or crimes with partial political elements. And what is that I propose here? I propose translating the amnesty elements into elements of political crimes. And I name here the four elements that I propose. The first is the legal interest. How did the interest involved in amnesty translate into the legal interest of political crimes? As I mentioned before, it seems to me that the interests protected by political crimes are the interests of the state. Also, when we analyze the parties to the crime, as in who can figure as the perpetrator and the victim of the crime, it would be the state as the victim, because this is basically the rationale behind the existence of a political crime, and also the perpetrator as any other person who is opposing the state, which means this relation of opposition is an element of the political crimes, which is also aligned with the observation that I did concerning self-amnesties. The material elements would be the limitations to the conduct when assessing different levels of violence at the contextual threshold, which I approach as in the amnesty concept as the exceptional aspect of amnesties. And finally, the mental element. Does motivation impact the mental element? Is the motivation enough, the political motivation enough to by itself cover deem a crime as a political crime, and by this enable it to receive amnesty? And this would be, for instance, a rhetorical question and an example concerning terrorism, which might have a political element. And with this, I finish my presentation. I would like to thank you so much for your attention, and I'm open to the questions.